Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Reeder.
And today we're here. We're here with Derek Muller. He gave himself an intro. He was ready. Look at that. I think you're the only guest to just jump right in there.
What a jerk.
It's great. You're prepared. I like it. You're better known as Veritasium on YouTube. And I'm just going to give you a quick little setup here. You've got a Bachelor's of Science in Engineering from Queen's University in Ontario.
Oh, and really? Are you Canadian?
I'm Canadian.
Well, you were born in Australia.
I'm born in Australia.
Whoa, I'm from Ottawa.
There you go, fellow Canadians.
You have an economics degree. Is that right?
No, that's not right. I don't know who's saying that.
You're reading the wrong Wikipedia page.
I'm reading this on InfoWars. No, joking. No, I was looking at the wrong thing. I've got my notes all over the place. You have a PhD in physics from the University of Sydney. So you're one hell of a smart guy.
Well, yeah, it's one way to frame it, but I don't know about this designation of like smart guy. I don't think I would do very well on an IQ test. Like, I don't think that I just have like raw intelligence, but I think I was a pretty competitive kid. So, you know, whatever I saw everyone else doing, I wanted to do, but better. So I don't know. I guess I worked hard at it.
Another thing that's interesting about you is you're also a filmmaker, and you started making videos with your friends back before YouTube was a thing. And that was like, when I found this out about you, I was like, oh, that's crazy. Cause I was kind of the same, and not many people our age, were into the videos before YouTube. It's like, so it's a pretty rare thing. So cool.
Back in like 2001, 2002, we were making really, really bad videos. So
you actually had the balls to put your videos from then up publicly. I have not done this, but maybe I'll have to follow in your footsteps.
Yeah, you got to do it. I mean, I love having my history online so that people can see where I started, because, you know, like things weren't very good, and totally. I'm still battling with every video to try to make it like decent. So it's always that journey, right? And I think it's nice that you can see it.
That's true. That's true. That's a good philosophy. Yeah. I like that. So so you were one of the first, you were early on YouTube. You were like 2010 or 2011, or what year did you get on there?
Yeah, I really started full-time in 2011. I quit working full-time so that I could focus on YouTube.
Okay. And you've always been like a science channel there.
Yeah. Like my background obviously is very science heavy. Like I tried to apply a couple times to a drama school in Sydney. Same one that like Russell Crowe and Kate Blanchett and Mel Gibson went to. So this is like the elite, you know, if you want to be an actor, this is where you go. And I got turned down twice, but it's super hard to get in, but like, yeah, they weren't having any of it. And I tried to apply to this film school, which again takes just a very small number, like 4 people into directing, 4 into producing, and they turned me down a couple times. And I feel like coming in there with this resume that's like, I'm an engineer into physics, got a PhD, you know, it just, on paper, I was just not a creative person.
Yeah.
But I like, and also I was probably just horribly untalented. So that, you know, add that all together and it makes sense. But I wanted to be creative. So, you know, I got to a point in my life where I was like, I have enough money to like pay the rent now. And I loved the job that I did. Like, it was a good job. I was working at a tutoring company. I was teaching students and I loved it. I was in the, you know, I had a ton of autonomy. My boss was good. The pay was good. Like, everything was great about it. But I was just at this point, like I was 27 years old, coming up 28. And I was just like, no, I have to quit and try to make videos, because I've always told myself that that is what I want to do. And so that's what I did. I quit working full time. I went down to like 15 hours a week teaching, and that was enough to pay the bills. And I feel super lucky that I had that circumstance, but that allowed me to devote, you know, 40, 50 hours a week to just making YouTube videos.
Wow.
So that's how I got my start.
Super cool. That's awesome.
I was inspired by people like you, Julian, because, you know, like Malk is one of these videos that I still love showing to everyone who I meet. And I'm also a big fan of the Jeffrey saga. I was thinking about it the other day as I was putting one of my kids to bed, that my firstborn, I would sing him a variant of the Jeffrey song as like a way to get him to sleep.
Oh my God. He would go to sleep to that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Which song?
Maybe it was often when he was crying and I was trying to calm him down.
Oh,
and I
okay.
would like sing his name and say like, I've been wondering how you've been and stuff, you know?
Oh, right, that right one. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's was funny.
Were you thinking of a different Jeffrey song?
Oh, well, when you said Jeffrey song, my head just went to Jellyfish because that's the one people usually
yeah.
just call Jeffrey song.
That's a good one.
But, right. But
yeah,
this
is the song, I know the one you're talking about. Oh, Jeffrey. Yeah.
Yeah, that one's, I guess I could see that one being slightly soothing if it was a little slower. But yeah, I'll have to pass that one on to Jeffrey. I'm sure he'll be flattered.
Yeah, I'm sure he would.
So today, I guess, we had tossed around a few different topics for discussion today. And I think one of them was chaos theory. Is that of interest?
Yeah.
You've got a recent video on the butterfly effect, so.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a long-term obsession for me, this idea of chaos. One of the big reasons is, I think, like when you study science and physics going through, the problems that they give you or the sort of areas of physics that they give you are typically areas that are tractable. They're areas that you can solve. So they give you problems where you can work through the mathematics and come up with an answer and feel great about yourself. Like that's, but that makes sense. Like, what are you going to give students like unsolvable problems when they start? Like, no. So like, I kind of get it, but I do think that students of science can come out the other end imagining our world as a very deterministic and predictable place. Like at its very core, and I don't know if we want to go there, but at its very core, I think this goes to the question of free will. Like, do we have free will? And chaos sits for me right in there. I don't know. Right. What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I do think even with chaotic systems, they are usually deterministic. They're just really, really difficult to predict. They're super sensitive to initial conditions, right? Like, I actually kind of don't believe in free will. I do believe that the universe is based on the initial conditions, but it's so pseudo-random that it's impossible to really work it out. Like, you could never, in even like kind of a Heisenberg uncertainty, like trying to measure it would change it. Therefore, you can't really ever measure it. But the thing is, that doesn't mean it's not deterministic, meaning given a set of initial conditions, things will always turn out a certain way. And I think even in chaos, that's true. It's just, it's so sensitive to what those initial conditions are, it's really difficult to figure out what that outcome is going to be.
Well, free will,
yeah.
Touching on what you just said, Andrew, free, you know, you said it's all based, you said there is no free will because, or you think there's no free will because it would all be based on the initial conditions of everything, but the initial conditions of everything wouldn't necessarily impact people's it may affect their options of how they can react to something, but it's not going to affect like a thought that they may have or an idea they may have. Is that wrong?
The initial conditions means that there is no free will, is what I'm saying. So basically the universe started in a certain way and everything is a product of that. I mean, at least you could look at it one way. I don't think chaos really touches on that. It could be wrong. Eric, what do you think?
Well, let me sort of dig in here to sort of synthesize what I hear going on, which...
Uh-oh.
What I hear Andrew saying, well, or thinking on a deep level, is that humans are just sacks of particles,
yeah.
Right? And all of our particles obey the laws of physics. So every thought you have is actually just some sort of incredibly complicated concert of all these particles playing together. But none of those particles is disobeying the laws of physics. So that's why I think a typical physicist would say we have no free will, because we're essentially this sack of particles which is interacting with all these particles in the universe, and the collisions are just happening like billiard balls, essentially, and our actions are the outcome of all of those interactions. So I tend to agree with Andrew that if you want to be technical about it, chaos doesn't change anything because systems are still deterministic. But I do feel like there's a tiny bit of wiggle room in there, because with chaotic systems, as we say, they're so finely determined by the initial conditions that you could actually never know the initial conditions with enough specificity that you'd be able to predict, say, anyone's actions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I take a certain amount of comfort in that even if there is no actual free will, if no one can predict what you're going to do in the future, we may as well say there's free will. Like on a certain level, that's where I'm
right.
willing to say, like, if prediction is out of the question, which I think chaos takes off the table for a lot of these systems, then I think that's about as close as we can get if we do assume that there's nothing else in our universe except stuff, the stuff that we're made of, interacting in unpredictable ways.
Do you want to explain what chaos is at a basic level? I don't know that everyone necessarily knows that.
Sure.
Like the butterfly effect or something like that, maybe an example.
Yeah, effect or chaos theory or nonlinear dynamics. So there are certain systems that you can have. The simplest that I can think of is like a double pendulum, which is essentially just a pendulum with another pendulum at its end. And just certain systems, because of the way they sort of interact, end up being really, 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 really sensitive on how you start them out. So with one of these double pendulums, if you tried to make it swing the same way by just like lifting it up in exactly the same way and letting it go exactly the same way, initially it might do some sort of similar behavior. But if you wait, you know, not very long, pretty soon the two pendulums that you tried to make identical are totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're just slightly off. Like you could never get it close enough that you're always going to get the same effect.
Yeah. That's the thing. These systems seem to amplify any tiny difference in initial conditions. Mm. So it's like, you know, you're playing a game of pool. What if you moved one pool ball by an animator or something? Like, there's kind of an assumption in physics that, like, little changes should have small effects downstream. And for a lot of systems, that is true. But for chaotic systems, it's the opposite. It's that tiny differences result in huge differences down the track.
So you're saying this can even affect people's thoughts and whether or not they choose to randomly add a couple skips into their walk to work?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the idea being that like the human brain is a physical system.
Wow.
Which, if it worked according to basic laws of physics, you know, would be completely predictable. But if you throw some chaos into there, it may still be deterministic, but unpredictable because we couldn't know all the initial conditions of all the particles in their brain.
See, Andrew and I did an episode on free will last year. I think it was called Free Will or Free Won't. And I got all the way through that episode thinking that we were talking about, like, purely the actions being the result of the initial condition of the system. Not that everything was a byproduct of it. That is like, that's super frustrating.
Right?
That's so frustrating.
The only way it could not be true if there's kind of like some leakiness into our universe of some external forces, right? Because everything in our universe is contained within our universe. It's a product of our universe, right?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
Actually, Derek, you may be able to comment on this, but gravity is like somehow thought to be some kind of force leaking into our universe or something like that?
I don't know if I can speak to that, but gravity does seem a little weird. And dark matter, for example, you know, this stuff that interacts gravitationally but not in other ways, also super, super strange. I think this conversation is partly why people were so drawn to dualism, right? The idea that there was the physical world and then there were souls, you know, this sort of ethereal gooey stuff or whatever. So if it was found at some point, I don't know how this would work, but if it was found at some point that there was some sort of physical manifestation of a soul, well, that would, I think, give more credence to the idea of free will. There's something that didn't obey the laws of physics as we understand them and could meddle in our brains. Let's say it only coupled to very complex electric circuitry or something.
Yeah, because everything in our universe is just responding to other inputs in our universe. So it's just following this script, basically, right? I mean, there's no way to break the script unless you have some external force outside the universe coming in to introduce uncertainty and randomness. And there, I mean, basically, as far as we know, there's no such thing as randomness. Things appear random, but it's actually because of chaos. This is exactly how computer random, pseudo-random generators work. They basically generate a large... They perform a computation that results in a number that is way too large for like the computer variable to handle, and it kind of over exceeds it and then kind of resets, flips multiple times, and then it ends up with something that was kind of difficult to predict going from the start. Isn't that right? Something like that.
Yeah. The thought that I had while I was making my video about the butterfly effect, which is meant to give this sense of like, butterfly flapping its wings can cause a tornado in Texas or something. That's giving you the sense of like scaling up of tiny disturbances or tiny, you know, changes to initial conditions. But the thought I had while making the video was, well, I mean, technically the butterfly is still part of my system and the butterfly has no free will. So there is no option for it to not flap its wings because it was always going to flap its wings if that mm-hmm. is what it did, you right. know, and totally. Therefore yeah. the tornado. So like, did it really cause it? Or I don't know, like it was always like that.
It was an accomplice
was going to propagate.
A willing accomplice.
Or was it an unwitting accomplice? Was it just like, you know, part of our system of
yeah.
billiard balls hitting billiard balls?
No more than any other butterfly.
Right. Or any other thing happening at that moment, including me waving my arm and someone closing their door.
Theoretically, a butterfly flapping its wings on another planet is somehow connected to our system, but it's isolated so well that any effect right. is going to take, you know, ages. A lot of time to actually be seen here.
For sure, for sure.
With like the computer random number too, you have to have a seed with a random number generator, and you put, mm-hmm. The computer uses time basically because time is something that's changing throughout, and if you go down to the milliseconds, it's a really large possible span of variables. But if you do it at the exact same time, or if you, for example, forget to reset the time, in going into the random number generator, it's always going to generate the same number. So I think the universe is kind of just like that. It takes some random seed and give it the same seed, it's going to come up with the same response. So you ask a computer for a random number. If you don't change what the initial condition is, it's going to give you the same answer. But when you run a program, it just usually uses some kind of variable that changes, namely time, and comes up with a different answer every time.
So what does this mean about randomness and quantum mechanics? Like, does that mean that that's really not randomness?
So that is an interesting point, because if there is a candidate for randomness, it is the quantum mechanical realm.
Right.
Because our best theories are only probabilistic there. And so when you eventually do measure the system and figure out where the particle went, that to me seems like true randomness. Would you agree, Andrew?
Yeah, it's hard to tell if it's just inscrutable or actually yeah. random, right? Like
all sorts of like really advanced code crackers, and people have like looked at it to try to figure out if there's a signal in there. Mm-hmm. And no one's been able to find one.
Could it be that the engine of quantum mechanics is like removed from what we experience in some way or something like that? Like maybe it's not bound by the initial conditions of the system?
That's what I kind of mean by some other effect leaking into the universe, whether it's really from outside the universe or not. The quantum world is very strange, and if it's quite possible that there's something that we don't understand that's kind of generating some impetus that is shaking things up at the quantum level. But basically, that is beyond our understanding of the laws of physics. I mean, we understand quantum theory only in so much as to make probabilistic estimates, which is, you know, what Derek was saying. So we can't really know where particles are going to end up and things like that, right? Like electrons, you try to measure them and it changes them. That's Heisenberg uncertainty. And
yeah. And I mean, to me, it seems like the universe fundamentally doesn't know these things, or like their values are undefined. That's where I immediately think with these things. Like, before you observe the thing, I would say its position doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't box. Have just one position. And that's where I feel like we could get true randomness. So the argument I've made in the past, and I don't know whether this actually holds water, but I put it out there to you. The argument I've made in the past is if you couple this true randomness that comes out of quantum mechanics that no one's really been able to figure out with chaotic systems, which amplify tiny differences in initial conditions, it feels to me like you can get some true, very different outcomes down the track based on quantum mechanics interacting with chaotic systems.
Hmm.
And if I were to make a bet for what is a chaotic system, I would bet our brains are chaotic because they're so, you know, complex and interwoven. So if there's any uncertainty in there that could be scaled up, then maybe that is what I would point to as a form of free will, would be that there's some things we can't know about positions and momenta of particles, which then get determined through some sort of measurement and then get scaled up through our very complex chaotic brains. And that is where I would point to and say, that's free will. But a lot of people would say, well, that's just rolling the dice. That's not free will. And to that, I would say, well, where do you expect free will to be if not that? Like,
actually, you say, but are you rolling the dice? Or did the dice roll themselves?
A die is actually a good example of a chaotic system because you can't really, it's hard to know exactly where it's going to land. Yeah, that's the really simple one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so we've gone down a rabbit hole.
So with your video, are you looking at kind of historic applications of the chaos theory or how it's actually, like what are some examples of how it's useful? And I mean, it's not, so yeah. What is like chaos theory is, I understand, is kind of like, oh, well, things are weird and we can't predict them. But that's not helpful mathematically.
There is more to it, right? So the way that there's more to it is to say, okay, there's some systems which are incredibly sensitive to initial conditions. So what we can do with them is we can try a whole range of different initial conditions, and we can see where those conditions go in a sort of space of possible outcomes. So essentially, imagine, you know, sticking a dot in a three-dimensional grid, and now that dot is going to start moving based on your deterministic equations. What's interesting is that for most of these systems, if you put a whole bunch of random dots all around the space and then watch how they evolve, they typically all go towards some sort of object, you could say. And this is called the attractor. It's called like a strange attractor sometimes, or a chaotic attractor. But the idea is all these particles at some point become moving together. And in the first attractor that was found, the first chaotic attractor that was found, this object looks a bit like a warped butterfly.
Why do they attract? So is it kind of like gravity?
Oh, this is the Lorentz.
So the funny thing,
are you talking about like a conceptual thing? Or are you talking about mass? Or what are you talking about?
Yeah, okay. So let me try to break it down a little more clearly. That this is not like a physical attraction. It's kind of like it's an attraction of the state to something. So
like stability, something like that.
Yeah, the simplest example I can give you is like a pendulum in a grandfather clock. You could imagine plotting in two dimensions, I hope, the position on one dimension and the velocity of the pendulum on the other dimension.
Okay.
And what you'll end up getting if you say, okay, I'm going to pick my initial condition is here, then what do you see? You see a loop forming in your space. And if someone comes along and bumps the clock, you'd see that thing sort of jiggle off that line. And then it would kind of come back and it would end up going back on that line. So it would end up sort of attracted to that loop is one way to think of it. But it's not like gravity or any sort of springy force. It's like the system is attracted to a certain set of states in a certain order.
So if you're basically, that's a way of saying the pendulum wants to stop swinging and...
it wants to keep swinging the same way. So even if someone bumps the clock or whatever, it'll jiggle a little bit, speed up, slow down, or slightly get off track.
I see.
But pretty soon, if you let it go, it's going to come back to its normal swing. Because
Isn't that just damping in a system? So it's like the system. Isn't that just damping in a elastic system?
Yeah, I mean, but there's not only damping. There's also a little like spring or something in the clock to keep it going, right? Because otherwise it would stop. So you know, you could have those clocks that come down with the weights, or you know, there's various ways. But all of those things stabilize that system into one that's sits on a nice little loop and has a perfect orbit of a second. Because if it didn't have that, then the clock would get off, right? So the whole system has to have some sort of, you know, desire to go back to that thing and do only that. So the point with these original chaotic systems was, although you couldn't predict any one path, what you could do is say, if we had a whole bunch of different initial conditions, they would generally try to go around and around in this space. And so you could sort of define a space where you're going to find these states. I wish I could give you like a picture. I mean, we could Google Lorentz attractor, but that's essentially what I'm talking about. It's like these infinite lines that spiral around. So the reason that's useful is because although you can't say anything about a single state, because it's going to end up sort of wandering kind of seemingly randomly around on this path, but you can say something about an ensemble of states. So you can say that, you know, if you're looking at the weather, that, you know, there's going to be hurricanes in Florida, you know, 3% of the months of August and September or something. And maybe that becomes a stable thing, even though predicting the path of any one hurricane is impossible. But you can give some sort of long-term averages. So the argument would be that even though weather is unpredictable, for example, there is such a thing as climate, right? There is an average which comes out of these systems.
I'm tracking with you. Yeah, I'm tracking with you.
I mean,
like, I'm just trying to shut up and let you talk because
this is one of the differences between science and engineering. In science, we're trying to quantify everything and figure out how things work. In engineering, we don't really care how they work. We just need them. We need to find a practical solution, basically. So, for example, when you're looking at temperatures for launches and you're trying to figure out like what the weather is going to be like in Florida, I don't care. We don't have to model it. You just have to look at historical data and see what's the probability of certain temperatures, right? So it's kind of exactly what you're saying. The other thing is with like mechanical systems in engineering, often we don't really know how to quantify them very well, but we kind of map them into state space and we find stability reinforcing features that would tend to cause systems to converge on certain solutions. So I think it's kind of similar to what you were saying, like with that, with like a pendulum problem or something. You have characteristics of a system that introduce damping or attractions to a certain state. So even if you have perturbations, those perturbations are going to get damped out over time. But it sounds like that's kind of the opposite of what chaos is, because you could also imagine the opposite of damping in a system, which would be you hit the grandfather clock, instead of returning to pendulum, it gets worse and worse and worse, right? So it diverges rather than converging to a solution.
So the example of the grandfather clock is a system that is not chaotic, right?
Okay,
The example of the grandfather clock is one that comes back nicely to its state. But you're quite right, the chaotic systems, little perturbation, boom, the thing's doing something you totally didn't expect. So that's 100% right. One of the uses of chaos is that now when, say, weather forecasters go to make their predictions, they don't just make a single prediction as they might have in the past. They try jiggling around the numbers a little bit, the initial conditions, and they see what other paths are possible if we're wrong a little bit about this or wrong a little bit about that. So, you know, when you see like spaghetti plots and stuff of where the hurricane's going, that is doing that kind of jiggling to see like, well, actually one time in 100, it's actually going to go over here and hit Alabama. So
if you extend the line.
Right. Yeah. So it's accepting that there's a certain amount of like, we can't predict it perfectly. So let's give a range rather than give a single answer. I think similar to what you were saying, some systems are have transitions between chaos and not chaos. And so by studying the science of this, you can figure out where those transitions are. And that can turn out to be really useful. Again, like if you're engineering a system, you can find there's like a tipping point where it tips over into chaos. And if you scale back on this factor by 5%, well, now it's not going to be chaotic.
So, what kind of systems go back and forth between chaotic and static or consistent? I don't know what the alternative would be.
Yeah.
Predictive maybe?
What's predictable?
So like one example of this would be fluid flow. So you got your, let's say, a pipe with some, you know, liquids coming down it. And you can make it go faster and faster and faster. And the whole flow is laminar, which means it's a nice, beautiful, streamlined flow. And then you're going to hit a certain point and the whole thing's just going to go boom. And it's going to be turbulent. You're going to get all these swirls and eddies and crazy stuff happening all over. But you just pull the speed back a little or make that pipe just a little bigger. Or, you know, there's just subtle things you can do and you bring it back to laminar. So it's like a phase change. It's like you have water, ice, or, you know, water, gas. You know, it's like, does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think my head just turned into gas. We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise. You've done a lot of interesting stuff, Derek. Are you still, I was reading that you were on the, correspondent for the Bill Nye series. Is that show still going? Are you still doing that?
So that show has ended. Yeah.
Okay.
So the Bill Nye on Netflix, 3 seasons and out. Is the way it went. Yeah.
Okay. So, what was, you know, I mean, that's not, this question doesn't have to be limited to your experience on that show, but just in general in your work, as both an engineer and, a physicist, what's like, what's the craziest problem you've had to solve that like brought together all of your skills, or like what's the just the most insane project you were a part of or something like that?
So I would say the weirdest once in a lifetime thing that I did was visit Chernobyl and Fukushima.
Wow.
So, yeah. I made 3 hours of a documentary for PBS about uranium and radioactivity.
Huh.
So we went into those sort of forbidden zones. You know, Fukushima was probably a couple years after that accident. Chernobyl was nearly 30 years after. But both of those experiences were super strange and things I never thought I'd be able to do. Or, yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
Are they similar in terms of level of residual radioactivity? Is the danger similar? Do you have to take similar precautions? How big is the exclusion zone around Fukushima? I think with Chernobyl, it's probably like, what, like 30 miles or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know the exact dimensions. I know that when I was measuring levels in both places, they were similar. But of course, it was only a couple of years after Fukushima, but 30 from Chernobyl. So the initial release of radioactive material was probably 10 times as much at Chernobyl than it was at Fukushima. But because it's so much fresher, you get exposed to a significant amount of radiation. It's interesting. One thing I think people don't know is, like, if you see pictures of me from those zones, I'm wearing, you know, like a white coverall hazmat suit and gloves and booties and everything. The thing that people don't necessarily know is that, like, that hazmat suit doesn't protect you very much. Mm-hmm. Like, the radiation, the gamma rays in particular, go straight through it and straight through your body. You can stop some of the other radiation. There's alpha rays and beta rays, which are coming out, but they're stopped by a certain amount of air anyway, so they're mostly close to the ground. But the whole purpose of suiting up like that is really to prevent contaminated dirt and stuff from getting on you and maybe stop you from like ingesting it or eating it or inhaling it. That is probably your kind of worst case scenario. There was this case in 2006, I think, of a guy named Alexander Litvinenko, who was living in London, former KGB spy. And he came down with this awful, awful illness. He was hospitalized. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. Did he have a disease? It took several weeks. Eventually, they figured out that he had eaten some radioactive material, some radioactive polonium. And this radioactive polonium spits out alpha particles. And this is a particularly nefarious way to kill someone, because if you have this polonium like outside your body, let's say separated from you by at least a foot, those alpha particles are actually stopped by the air. So they don't actually hit you. They're not going to cause you any damage. But if you get them in your body, if you eat that polonium, then it's spitting out these alpha particles, which are essentially like subatomic bullets that are just ripping through your tissues. So you're actually doing the stopping of these alpha particles. So they're not leaving your body. So if someone scans over you with a radioactive meter, they don't read anything because your body is stopping them all. And in doing the stopping, it is getting ripped to shreds on the cellular level and on the molecular level.
Oh my gosh.
So pretty horrible way to die. So yeah, he died within a span of 3 to 4 weeks. Horribly painful death, multiple organ failure, that sort of thing.
Oh my God.
Putin, we think, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing about radioactive substances is they are so traceable. Like, the amount of polonium-210 that you need to kill someone is, I don't know, it's not tiny. It's very small, but to make that amount, you'd need a significant reactor. And the only place that has, like, these sorts of reactors that could make this amount was Russia. So it's kind of like killing someone with a calling card, being like, yes, you're dead. And we showed you that we did it, and there's no doubt that anyone else could have done it because only we can make this stuff that killed you.
Wow. So this guy didn't die as an accident, like from just being stupid. Somebody killed him.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
He was poisoned, and they could trace back his day, and they could actually... The thing about radioactive materials is they're so easy to trace once you know what you're looking for. They could trace it back to a particular sushi restaurant, I think, earlier in the day, or maybe it was a tea house in London where I think someone had slipped it into his tea. And they
Nuclear
could trace
tea.
It back to the plane. they could trace it back to the plane where it came from. Because if you leave just a few, you know, atoms, I mean, you're not going to leave just a few. You're going to leave, you know, 10 to the 10 atoms. You're going to leave zillions, but no one's going to see them. But if you come along with a Geiger counter and where they are, you're going to see exactly the right energy for this particular isotope, polonium-210. So it's like you have no doubt, and you can basically track the whole thing the whole way. You can wow. track where they went. Yeah.
That's insane.
So with Chernobyl, like in the series, for example, they kind of almost implied that people became contagious in some way, which is definitely not true. But to what extent does like the radioactivity, I guess it must be like dust or whatever that gets in the dirt, as you say, like, so it's the suit was to prevent you from getting like the dust on you. But if you got exposed to radiation, you wouldn't become radioactive unless you're actually
That's right.
coated in some kind of dust or whatever like that. So
This is a great misconception, again, one that I tried to tackle, this idea that, like, okay, there's radiation, which are the tiny bullet-like things which are coming away from the radioactive material, which is the actual atoms that, like, came out of the reactor. And it's important to differentiate between the two, because these little bullets only exist for a short period of time, and typically they don't travel very far. It's the radioactive dirt and the atoms that you want to stay away from. Because they're essentially little ticking time bombs going off, you know, every now and then. And the worst thing you want to do is spend a lot of time around them. And even worse, of course, eating them and then having them go off inside you. That's, you know, the very, very worst, which is why people are so careful around Fukushima and Chernobyl about, like, not eating the produce from those areas once those sorts of releases of radiation have happened, because the radioactive material goes into them and then they're sitting there waiting to go off on you.
When you say the radioactive material goes into them, it's not the fact that they've been exposed. So if you grow like lettuce or something, the fact that the lettuce has been exposed to radiation doesn't matter at all. It's that maybe there was some actual dust, some actual physical material that came over from the plant or something, and then maybe it got absorbed through the roots or something like that, or maybe it's just like dusting the outside of the lettuce leaves or something like that. But if you washed the lettuce really well, I don't know how likely it is that the particles would actually get into
it. He wants to eat this lettuce so bad.
It's the radiation challenge.
Well, I'm scrunching up my face because there are some of these atoms.
I would never eat
like, there's some of these atoms like iodine-131 and stuff. There's some of these things that will dissolve in the water and then they'll end up getting sucked up into things like lettuce or fish or plums so the idea is like if it's been in a radioactive zone where the radioactive material has been sprinkled on the ground, like just don't eat it. But on the other hand, if you have lettuce and someone has like gamma rayed it or x-rayed it like to crap, well, that's fine because it shouldn't cause any problems. Like once it's away from that radiation. And, you know, they may have sterilized it, so killed off the bacteria or whatever that were on
I mean, it probably wouldn't even be less healthy, right? Because we don't really consume the DNA of things where you work on a macro scale. So your body just uses the carbon and basically breaks chemical bonds to gather the energy, right, between, like, fats and, you know, and proteins and stuff like that. So it wouldn't even matter.
Yeah.
Because radiation doesn't even work on that level. So it'd be just as healthy lettuce, too.
You would think it should be healthy,
Even though its DNA might be all shredded.
Derek, what do you think about nuclear energy as a solution for climate change? Are you pro-nuclear, anti-nuclear?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of knee-jerk anti-nuclear that's not me. Like, I think we should consider what are our options for generating carbon-free power and nuclear is definitely an option. Where I see it have challenges, and this is something that came up when I was doing this documentary, was that it's really expensive to create these plants. And they're typically very large plants. Well, that's how they've been made historically. And because of the risk of catastrophic failure, it's typical that you can't get a private company to, say, insure the power plant against any sort of incident. You need a state, you know, you need a country to say, we will insure it against these sort of things because no one has enough liability to cover it. So they run into all these sorts of problems and end up, for those reasons, being more expensive than you'd think they should be. There's all sorts of other issues with, like, political problems around where do we store it, and regulation problems around how do we handle it. And all these things just add up to an extremely high cost for something where if you could imagine a better way to do it, and people are imagining better ways to do it using smaller reactors and safer reactors, and if we could find a way to handle the material better or recycle old, you know, material better and prevent proliferation and stuff like that, I can imagine a potential solution. But it's just like the realities that exist in the world today make me say it doesn't seem like a practical solution that is like ready for prime time right now.
Seems dangerous.
And that is affordable. I don't even think the danger is the biggest thing. I think the big thing is the cost. Like if you're gonna invest this amount of money in this, there's a lot of other technologies, even like the way solar has come down and the way wind has come down, and even geothermal or tidal, or like there's a lot of other ways that you could look at investing your money that might end up paying dividends earlier than nuclear, just because of all the sort of stuff around it. You know, the fundamental idea of like radioactive stuff, heating water. It's like, okay, great.
Which one of those that you just listed off do you like best? Geothermal, solar.
It depends on the location. You can't really say one or the other. Right? Like if you have a big open plane with a lot of wind, wind power is the best. But
yeah, personally, like living in Southern California, I do like solar. Like I've got solar panels on my roof, and we get all of our electricity from the solar panels. Plus, we have electric cars, so the solar panels power those too. So we essentially use no extra electricity besides what we make on the roof. So
that's good.
That seems pretty good deal.
Yeah, but it's not like applicable to everywhere. Like in Seattle, too cloudy for someone to do that all the time, but maybe they do have, actually they have really great hydroelectric there, for example.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And BC, where I'm from, you know, in Canada, tons of hydro, yeah.
Are you from Vancouver or Victoria?
I'm from Vancouver, yeah.
Cool, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice place.
Yeah.
Well, we solved free will and we solved climate change. Way to go. That's a pretty successful 45 minutes. I can't think of where else we should take this. I mean, we've got a lot here. I guess one thing I do want to ask is have either of you seen Inside Bill's Brain, that documentary on Bill Gates? It's on Netflix.
No, I haven't.
You got to watch it. It's part of the reason I brought up nuclear, because I've been watching it this week and they touch on nuclear. And apparently Bill Gates started this new startup to look into nuclear as a solution to climate change. And it all got shut down because of the trade deal with China and Trump. So basically they had some deal with China to Bill supposedly had some idea to make nuclear safe and cost effective, but didn't happen. That's why I was curious to hear your thoughts on like what other solutions might be a better option. Because there's got to be better options than nuclear.
Well, it sounds like you think it should be in the mix. It's just a matter of, is it competitively priced versus other solutions, right? Because the cost that comes from the regulatory stuff and the danger of it and stuff like that, the risk.
Yeah, I think... When I for the documentary, we interviewed some people who were, you know, trying to design the next generation of nuclear. Mm-hmm. But it was like, this stuff is like 10, 20 years away. I feel a little bit like the disaster in 1986, Chernobyl, kind of cut down a generation of would-be scientists, researchers, people going into nuclear science because, you know... Yeah. just how disastrous it was, you know. But because of that, we're really behind when people are like, oh, let's just go to nuclear. But it's like, no one's doing nuclear right now. Mm-hmm. And not even because of the danger, just because it's super expensive and it's huge. And like, we don't have the research that should have been done 20 years ago such that we could make the smaller, you know, versions and the things that are safer going forward. So maybe it comes online and like there's like fusion power, which is like, always going to be 10, 20 years away. That's the way it seems for the last 50, 60, 70 years. So it's just like, I wish we were closer with these technologies, but it just doesn't feel like they're close. And in the meantime, like how hard is it to stack a couple layers of semiconductor and get the power from the sun? Like, that just seems like that should be really easy and really simple. And what's nice about it is it's so modular. So, you know, if you want to install like just a few more panels here, a few more panels there, you can, and it's pretty cheap and it's not going to blow up. And
yeah,
so I don't know.
Well, this is probably a stupid question, but what is it? What do people mean when they say I know what they mean when they say fusion's always like 50 years out, but like, what does that mean? That it's working, but only in like very specific conditions? Or does it mean they haven't figured out how to make it work and they're hoping they will, but they might not? So what does it mean?
Okay. So the thing with fusion is getting more power out than you put in.
Right.
Because essentially to get fusion to work, you need the thing to be running at like 10,000 Kelvin or no, 10 million Kelvin, something like that. You need it to run really hot. So, Andrew, you want to jump in?
Well, so we know how fusion works in an uncontrolled reaction. Obviously, hydrogen bombs are based on that. So why couldn't you theoretically have a giant chamber that would detonate hydrogen bombs and you would collect the heat and boil it and pass it through a generator? So basically,
sounds like a great idea.
Fusion bomb power.
Why
right?
You
I
build
mean, it sounds super dangerous, of course. But other than the fact that it's going to blow up the world, what is the big drawback?
Yeah, well, I think doing it in a controlled way, right? It's that combination.
Well, I want to be in this boardroom where this gets pitched. You're going to blow up bombs and create energy.
Inside a very strong facility.
Inside a containment vessel. How big is your containment vessel?
The size of a city. And then...
so the first thing we need to do is build a containment vessel the size of a city.
What about Chernobyl?
Once we blow up
we can use Chernobyl.
Giant cave.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
and you know, the thing about fusion is like, I always used to think, okay, fusion's going to be a lot safer than fission in terms of, I mean, when you have fission going on, neutrons are coming out all over the place, and neutrons are nasty because they can pass through virtually anything because they're neutral. So there's no way to easily confine them. And the only thing they'll do is end up getting stuck in some nucleus. The point being that in a fission reactor, as that thing runs over 25 or 30 years, all these neutrons eventually leak out of the sort of innermost parts where you want them, and they end up degrading the whole structure of the reactor. So it's just kind of nasty. The truth about fusion is it's got the same issues. Like neutrons are, you know, coming out, and they will damage stuff around the reactor, and there's really nothing you can do. So I don't know. It's a lot messier than it seems. But yeah, if we could get controlled fusion to work and figure out how to deal with the safety issues and not make that horrendously expensive, then yes, that would also be a good idea. It just feels like the simpler ways should be better. I don't know. That's my gut feel.
I just think that in some places, per Andrew's point, in some places solar isn't a good candidate and people can't justify putting them on their roofs like you can in California. And then, you know, wind isn't always good in every place all the time, you know? So I think what it might come down to, you know, the governments might not be able to supply the citizens with like a replacement for, electricity, you know, coal powered or whatever it comes from. Like, they're probably not going to be able to give some kind of like civilization wide program to people. People are probably going to have to take it on themselves to do whatever works in their area.
It sounds kind of apocalyptic.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think we're going towards an apocalypse, but I'm a huge optimist, as you can tell. But I also think like we could find ways to reduce our energy use. Like there's so much fat, for example, in the US, not just literal, but also figurative in the case of energy. Like we could totally cut down, you know, by a factor of 10 the amount of energy we're using. So I think there's so much opportunity there. That like we don't have to shoot for generating this much necessarily.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to imply that we're heading towards an apocalypse because I think people are waking up to climate change and stuff. But I am concerned that there's a lot of people that, and we did an interview with the Doomsday Clock people a couple weeks ago, and we were talking to them about the climate change deniers and how many there still are, and like how that affects their mission, and it's like that's a very real concern. So like some of these places. You know, people are still waking up, and that's kind of, I don't know, it's going to be interesting.
I've received a surge of emails lately from people saying, Derek, I really think you should take a look at this climate change thing and dig into it. Like people who suspect it's a hoax.
You should. Like, I think that's a great idea.
Derek, like blow the lid off this thing.
Blow the lid off. Yeah, that's a great idea. You should.
Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated that there's a surge in these sorts of emails coming to me lately because I don't know.
I was really disappointed with the doomsday clocks people's answers. I was like, why don't you guys go after people who and try to like convince people? And they were like, well, our job is to equip the people that are looking for the information already, and then they can have the conversations with their friends and family who are skeptics. But I feel like there's this huge, you know, void of information for skeptics, you know, and it would probably be huge.
The skeptics don't want the kind of information. I mean, I find this like, it's like a quagmire. It's like, I've made a couple videos about climate change, but I just don't know what to do. I got friends who started a YouTube channel called Hot Mess, which is a PBS supported channel. And it's all about, like, every video is about climate change. But they have a real difficult time getting traction. And I can see exactly why. Because if you know about climate change, what's one more story about climate change? Who cares? And if you don't, you don't want to watch that stuff. So we are fundamentally stuck in this area where, and this has always been my feeling when I come to the U.S. and I can, like, turn on Fox News or CNBC. I feel like you can live in kind of like parallel worlds.
Again. Yeah,
in the same world with like a very complete narrative. And there's never anything that's going to burst that bubble and make you think like, hang on, but is this quite right? Because like you get it is such a rich world that you can inhabit here. And we don't all share the same world. This country shares like two very separate
visions
of everything. And I almost like, I feel like this country's ungovernable. It's, you know, I don't know.
It should be eight different countries. That's what I keep saying. But yeah. But I do think that it's a very important that skeptics be you can't force them to do anything, obviously, but I think that a lot of these people are surrounding themselves with bogus information, obviously, you know, but like I've been in debates with these people. I'm not even a scientist, but when I send them the stuff that I'm reading, I'm like, look at this, debunk this. People send me these like clearly bogus articles by these people who have half-baked, you know, credentials, and I feel like that's something that gets overlooked. Like the sources, the quality of the sources gets overlooked by the deniers. They're just like, oh yeah, this is credible because I read it. And it's like, well, no, look who wrote it and tell me where they studied and tell me how they got these answers. And, you know, most people probably don't want to spend the time, but I do think that, you know, there's got to be a way to get that conversation to happen, you know, for the skeptics.
Yeah. Science literacy. I mean, people don't really understand what's a fact and what's kind of not or opinion or whatever. And it's tough for people to be skeptical about things and discriminating about where evidence comes from and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all comes down to that tribal identity thing much more than it comes down to the particular facts or issues or sources. It's just like, you know,
absolutely.
This is what me and my people believe. And, you know, it doesn't matter what, you know, crazy stuff you drum up on your side. Like, this is who we are. So, you know, telling them that they're wrong is like challenging their identity, which I think is much more difficult than like just if we could have a civilized discussion about what is or is not true or what the files or what the facts do or don't support. I mean, having this conversation makes me think like, oh, do I need to try to tackle this topic again? I probably do, but I don't know. I hate doing it. The first video I made about it was called Climate Change is Boring. Because I legitimately feel like from a scientific perspective, yeah. It is.
It's like,
what is this? This is old science that we all know the story. It's the gas and blah, 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 slightly more, you know, of this radiation, blah, blah, blah. It's just like the dullest story you could ever tell. The other side has a much better narrative to tell, right? Can I tell you about Al Gore and his environmental cronies who are flying around the world in their private jets promoting a Chinese hoax so that they can that is so much more of a compelling story.
Yeah.
The truth is so unbearably boring.
Mm-hmm. It usually is. The truth is usually boring.
Can I ask you a question, Julian?
Of course.
Do you have plans to make some more videos?
I actually just made one last week, my first one in a long time. Before that, it had been a few months. I get asked this question a lot, and it kind of makes me laugh.
Haircuts. I've seen the ones where you're getting haircuts.
Okay.
But I have not seen, is there like a more of like a return to form?
Well, Jeffrey did Jeffrey participated in the impeachment inquiry last week.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I didn't really talk about it because I'm not really on social media, but it's up there. It's on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
He asked some really difficult questions about cupcakes. So you can watch that one. I get asked this question about videos a lot, and it's kind of funny to me because I guess people just don't take the time to like watch the boring videos where you're just telling them what they need to know about the channel. But like, I've never like formally left YouTube. I've just stopped. I've always taken breaks. You know, I've always, even back in 2009, I took like a year long break and I came back and, you know, this is definitely the longest break I've been on, but I don't plan on like not releasing anything ever again. I just like, I really enjoy being behind the camera and I'm doing a lot of commercial directing right now and working with brands. And I really like that. I really like being part of the story and, you know, making the stuff and not always just in it. So that's something I've been really enjoying. But, you know, that YouTube channel, I would be stupid not to use it. So it's not that just because I'm not putting stuff there doesn't mean it's gone forever.
That is good to know.
Well, I think we've got plenty here. So unless there's anything else you guys want to cover while we're still rolling.
Did you want to promote anything, Derek, or plug anything?
Not really.
you have a video on Chaos coming out soon? Or
it's already out.
Soon? Oh, it's already out? Sorry.
Yeah. So if you want to look at some images of the attractors that I was talking about, cool. They are in the video.
Okay.
Sweet. Yeah.
Cool. Well, Derek, thanks so much for making the time. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed this. I'm trying to pull up your Twitter handle or something to plug because everybody knows
it's like Veritasium. It's Veritasium.
It's just Veritasium
everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, but I do kind of hate social media, so you know,
I do too.
Maybe
I'm the same way. Yeah. I like Twitter because it's got news and stuff, but you know, I don't really post that much. I'm just kind of like a stalker. I just kind of read the news and get off.
I kind of feel like I've gone that way because it does feel like a lot of social media is just like shouting into a void, like, hey, look at me, look at the thing I did, go here, do that. And it's like, no.
How
I don't
want
to tell anyone that.
So now I want to ask you a YouTube question. So how have you managed running a YouTube channel without social media? Because I've just found it's so intertwined now.
Yeah. I've always felt like it's kind of my job to also do Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And I've done them to a degree, but lately I've just been like falling off the wagon. So like, you know, in a year, maybe I'll post like 9 or 10 times on Instagram and maybe tweet like when there's a new video, but that's about it, you know, that sort of thing. So I do feel like the way YouTube has shimmied and shaken has led to a situation where like if YouTube is putting it in suggested or putting it on the homepage or like whatever they do, that can just make the video by itself. So I feel like there's a new kind of like YouTube virality, whereas in the past I feel like something that was viral on YouTube would also be viral on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and whatever. But now I feel like there's this like YouTube specific world. So
YouTube wants parodies and they want it to be as long as hell. And, you know, I feel like you're this makes me wish I was like I wish I had something I was, you can talk about science like at length easily in YouTube videos like that. I don't really have something like that I can go off in, you know, like I've just always made shorts. So, and shorts don't work on YouTube anymore. So that's part of the reason I've slowed down.
I was going to say like you and I are on a continuum. Where like at the one end there's like animated, you know, comedy or whatever, which is super hard and short. And then there's like sketch comedy and whatever. And then there's like science, which people could watch for a while, but let's face it, like you're not going to sit down and watch me lecture you for half an hour on nuclear physics, or like most people aren't. That's not a viral hit. that's not a viral hit, you know? And then, you go through to the end and that's when you get gamers who are like, I'm just going to sit there and watch this guy game for an hour. Like tons of people do that.
I find that crazy.
So I really think that has partly shaped, you know, who has risen and fallen over the last, you know, 5 years. It's crazy. Unintended consequences.
Yeah, ever since YouTube, I remember when they added the feature to where you could put in as many ads as you wanted in different places. And ever since that became the case, people started catching, YouTubers started catching on to the idea that, oh, if you can just get people to that second ad in your video, you make twice as much money per video. And then if you can get them to a third ad, you make three times as much. And then like, as soon as the conversation became about that, in my opinion, that's when like stuff just, you know, and that's not to say there's nothing good on YouTube, because clearly your channel is awesome. Otherwise we wouldn't be having you on here, and there's plenty of other people, but the scope of stuff that's on there is just way, way smaller. Like sketch comedy, pretty much gone. Animated shorts, there's some, but they're all like usually philosophical or educational or like some kind of like, you know, self-improvement kind of thing, you know? So I don't know. It just used to be so much more diverse. And like you said, if it was viral on YouTube, it'd be viral on a number of other sites. And now it's just so insulated. So it's kind of, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I do feel lucky that like, because I made content about science, like people come to the channel for the science,
yeah,
not necessarily for me. And like, yeah. So as long as the thing is interesting, I don't have to be that interesting. So that's the lucky part about doing a science channel.
Well, you're interesting whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, well, we are definitely wrapping this up now. We've already plugged your Twitter and your YouTube channel. Check out his Veritas. I almost called you Veritasium. Check out Derek's videos on YouTube. They're awesome. And if you want to follow Andrew and I on Twitter, I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider. And we do these episodes every Monday. Hope to have you back next week.
Thanks for listening.